you for coming to today's plenary session on transindigeneity. If our emphasis yesterday was to talk about the distinctiveness of the emergence of performance studies within Canada, in a way that was perhaps ad nauseum for Canadian scholars and Canadian expats who've heard some of these discussions over and over again, today we're taking a hemispheric perspective on performance. It was very important for us on the programming committee to reflect the extreme significance of First Nations art and cultural production to paradigms of performance and performance studies within Canada. As Jolene mentioned, as Johanna mentioned on the first day, welcome to our home on native land. And yesterday in Susan Bennett's talk, she also mentioned the importance of native ways of knowing for performance studies in Canada. But in some ways, the Canadian context is a bit different from the U.S. context in that here in Canada, we are slightly less amnesiac about the dimension of being a settler culture, whereas the U.S. context seems to have fallen prey to this myth of autochthonous self-generation. In Canada, there is at least more awareness of the issues of occupation of native lands, even if we do not have to the same degree the kind of co-national project that one can see in New Zealand in certain political initiatives, though things are very clearly contested, strongly contested. But it was very important to us that we have a panel on transindigeneity, in part because we're acutely aware that national borders, the U.S.-Canadian border, transects just as the U.S.-Mexican border transects indigenous lands. But also I want to thank all of the performers and presenters who have spoken on First Nations and Indigenous topics in the breakout sessions, who have spoken on Indigenous topics in other contexts, and also Laurie Blondeau for her performance yesterday, Wawate Phobister for his performance of a selection from Agukwe in the cabaret on Thursday night. Additionally, we invited other Native artists and scholars we had hoped to have. We were trying to get people like Kent Monkman and Laurie Blondeau, but Laurie is here. Rebecca Belmore is the other name I meant to mention. But I suppose it's a fortunate thing that people have other commitments and other gigs and weren't available at this time. So let me introduce our first speaker. What I want to do is we'll go in the order in the program, and I'll introduce each person individually before they're going to speak. And we'll hold comments and questions until the end. So let me first introduce Alicia Arizon. Alicia is professor and chair of the Department of Women's Studies at the University of California, Riverside. Her academic interests are firmly situated in contemporary cultural and performance studies, with a strong commitment to the examination of race and ethnicity and their interchange with gender and sexuality studies. She is the author of Latina Performance, published by Indiana University Press in 1999, and designated an outstanding academic title by Choice. She is also co-author of Latinas on Stage, published by Third Woman Press in 2001. Her most recent book, Queering Mestizaje, Transculturation and Performance, was published by the University of Michigan Press in 2006, released in 2007, was awarded the fifth annual MLA Prize in the U.S. Latina and Latino and Chicana and Chicano Literary and Cultural Studies for Outstanding Scholarship, and the ATHA 2008 Award for Outstanding Book in Theater and Pedagogy. Her presentation today is Trans-American Performance, Indigeneity, Gender, and Sexuality in Chicana and Chicano Culture. Please welcome Alicia Arizon.
Thank you very much. My thanks to the conference organizers for inviting me to be part of this plenary session. In particular, I'd like to acknowledge Lisa Wolford and Richie Wilcox and Laura Levin. Thank you so much for all your work. Let me start reading my paper. In postcolonial studies, theories agree that indigeneity is one of the most contentiously debated concepts. No official definition has ever been agreed upon. I need to put this here. It's too low. Indigeneity changes according to geopolitics, location, and time. While it may express the narratives of marginality, economic marginalization, racial, gender, and sexual discrimination, to some degree, the concept of indigeneity is highly contested because of the problem of representation. And I like to say here that what I mean is who, by this I mean who or what is standing in for the indigenous people, informing, representing, and speaking for the indigenous people. And I like also to add that as a Chicana scholar, I do not intend to speak for indigenous people or indigenous women here. I do connect, like most Chicanas, with an indigenous history that conveys a sense of origin and myth, partly justifying the sense of being from the Americas. By reclaiming the Americas, indigeneity is associated with a post-colonial condition and is the result of intellectual and political endeavor. Indigeneity as an embodied knowledge underlies different ideologies, sustaining the visibility-invisibility of power relationships. The title of my presentation today, Trans-American Performance, Indigeneity, Gender, and Sexuality in Chicano Culture, provides us with a framework to imagine the epistemology of indigeneity as marked in Chicano culture. In relating indigeneity to Chicana feminist articulation and the ideologies of mestizaje, I am defining it here as the abstract representation of indigenous communal consciousness, which recognizes collective, and I use collective in quotation marks, or group rights. Not surprisingly, since the 1960s, Chicana and Chicano scholars have made the most concerted effort to engage interdisciplinary discussions of indigeneity in their scholarship, tracing the ways it contributes to cultural memory, belongings, and ancestry. Through a process of self-affirmation, Chicana scholars and artists embrace indigeneity as a form of resistance against racial, economic, and political marginalization, while adapting and at the same time subverting hegemonic cultural traditions. Contemporary Chicana scholars and artists engage with mestizo cultural practices or hybridization by reinterpreting them within an indigenous feminist context. So indigenous symbols and traditions not only provide Chicana artists with original tools for their creativity, but also grant them access to epistemologies of cultural resistance. Indigenous knowledge becomes a means of empowerment, which enables Chicana to confront Eurocentric discourses, hegemonic patriarchal norms, and compulsory heterosexuality. So these are some of the main concerns I had examined in my book, Queer Mestizaje, and I'm beginning to expand that framework into working more deeply into some of the symbologies of indigeneity. So in that book, Queer Mestizaje, I provide cultural and historical perspectives on the concept of mestizaje, considering what is culturally, politically, and intellectually at stake in past and contemporary invocations of mestizaje. So, let me say that it is defined as an ideology which believes that the fusion of different cultural traditions in the American created a new race. And so in that context, I look at mestizo culture, how they represent more than the synthesis of indigenous tradition with those of the European and or African. So let me say that I just let me move on to the presentation, I wanted to make a parenthesis of what I have done. But it is not surprising that in the invocations of mestizaje, performance of indigeneity provide Chicana artists with Amerindian imagery, symbologies, and terminologies as adapted in their cultural and artistic productions. And I want to start by illustrating some of the examples how these engagements are demonstrated in this cover of a magazine. And the title of that magazine was Lesbian Activism from Latin America to Los Angeles, with a depiction of a very hyper-sexualized indigenous body. The figure here is a contemporary interpretation, and I say not interpretation, but reconceptualization of Tlatzolteot. And I'm going to be naming some of the indigenous names that I will later come to give a more explanation of them. In this case, Tlatzolteot, that is known as the Air Goddess, and this is by a Chicana artist, very contemporary Chicana artist, Alma Lopez. So the position of the body emphasizes its own eroticization, and in Aztec mythology, Tlatzolteot is associated with the moon and the earth. She is the goddess of sex. In her incarnation as Teotihuacan, mother of the gods, she is a protector of all midwives, the curanderas, the healers, if we can say doctor women, or in fortune tellers. So Tlatzolteot is one of the most endearing and complex goddesses of the Mesoamericans. Tlatzolteot is usually depicted sometimes wearing the skin of a human sacrificial victim and squatting over something. And she's also been seen carrying like a grass broom as a symbol of cleaning, of wearing a spindle of rock cotton on her headdress. So here is like a more, if you see the interpretation of a contemporary artist from the ancient, Aztec symbol of Tlatzolteot is this is an ancient representation. She's naked, holding a red serpent. And when we think about what the serpent means, is the serpent in Aztec mythology means symbolizes knowledge, and it's a very important symbol nowadays to find how the serpent is used in the symbology of Chicana art nowadays. So in performance art, the station of indigeneity is especially marked in the production of the Sister Colorado. And I'm making a transition here to a group called themselves, that they had adopted themselves a name that is a day that Tlatzolteot is a deity of Coatlicue, and this is the group that adopted the name Coatlicue Theater Company. And this very dynamic performance group draw on the narratives of the pre-colonial legacy, weaving stories of the indigenous goddesses along with their own personal and familial tales. And they present themselves as urban indigenous women living in New York City and performing in New York City. So they, in a way, their work that they perform is has a lot of symbolism with the Aztec and Nahuatl language. For example, in the previous one, the previous performance, that's when they did the performance of the Zapatista women, Caracol. They staged the voices of Zapatista women, the resistance and struggles, which from Chiapas. And then they have titles like Open Wounds on Tlatelolcli. And it's interesting because if you see all the even in their performances, sometimes they mix their English with Spanish and also Nahuatl language, and you how they embody in a way the how they mix their own experience with the indigenous symbolism. So in other like walks on Indian women, again we see here another marker of indigeneity in their work. And I'm very interested in the decision and how they use the name Coatlique for and how it testify to their commitment to a feminist, what I call a feminist indigeneity. You know, a very strong feminist commitment to their indigeneity. And then I like to make a transition from their sense of Coatlicue to Gloria Anzaldúa's theorization of indigeneity, how in a way in Gloria Anzaldúa's theorization of indigeneity, the process of decolonization must occur by entering what she calls the Coatlicue state. Anzaldúa uses the notion of the Coatlicue state to mark the conflicting powers of that Aztec deities within her psyche. So she explained how Coatlicue's legacy represents all the different parts of the philosophy of the Aztecs. She writes, and I quote, "Coatlicue is a symbol of the fusion of opposites, the eagle and the serpent, heaven and the underworld, life and death, mobility and immobility, beauty and horror," end of quote. So like Anzaldúa Mestiza's consciousness, Coatlicue is embodiment of contradictions. So a deity born of Coatlicue was Cihuacóatl, the serpent goddess. Cihuacóatl is also identified with Tonantzin, a goddess similar to the Christian Virgin Mother and is referred as to Our Lady. As deities, Cihuacóatl, and now you can see I'm talking about Coatlicue and how is the Nahuatl for what is called the one with the skirt serpent. And these are Coatlicue's deities from Tlatelolcli that I started talking at the beginning, and Cihuacóatl become the evil spirits. And then later is known like La Malinche, and La Malinche was the first woman that gave birth to the first mestizo son of the, you know, she was the mistress of the conquistador. So how they related, I see that. And then Tonantzin, another deity, becomes the good spirit, later known as the Virgin of Guadalupe. So as deities, Cihuacóatl and Tlatelolcli were disempowered. They were disempowered and given evil attributes during the transformation of Coatlicue's good spirits. Tonantzin into La Guadalupe, and Tonantzin became embodied as the chaste, protective mother of the mestizo nation, which is now the Virgin of Guadalupe. So as you know, this is known as the, later it was protected and in the process became Tonantzin, the Virgin of Guadalupe. As we know, it's very interesting, and I want to briefly review here how there is numerous in Chicana art, how there are numerous traditional and transgressive iconographies dedicated to the image of the Virgin of Guadalupe, and how they indicate, in a way, an amazing invocation of Coatlicue's revolutionary deity, how Chicanas in their quest for an indigenous body and transgress this good spirit by invoking to that deity that it was basically a tribute. It was disempowered. So for Chicanas in the midst of the Chicano movement, they create an image like the Virgin of Guadalupe fighting for the rights of Chicanos and how she becomes a fighter. You know, how in a way later she becomes, you know, the portrayal of the artist of the Virgin holding the serpent, holding the knowledge. And how these images, and you can find like, I would say at least I counted them, 3 to 4, maybe 40 of them that are basically conceptualizing the knowledge of these deities in different ways. So we see here from Yolanda Lopez how, in a way, they replace the passive traditional look. I mean, these two. Of the Virgin and one of the significant here is how they step on the angel. You know, if you see the chaste mother always embraces the angel as part of this motherhood. You know, and here they step on it and it's like, I mean, it's totally an act of resisting the and how they empower, in a way, that figure, the symbology. So it is clear, you know, that this, how, in a way, they are using an act of, in this case, an act of self representation, how it deals with accepting the power of divine knowledge by holding that serpent, I think is very symbolic. So, as I mentioned earlier, after the conquests, Tonantzin and Guadalupe was established as the good mother of the mestizo, and I'm going back to, if you see this one, this is, if you see the good mother of the mestizo, and Tonantzin Guadalupe was established as a good mother. And then, on the other hand, Coatlicue and her female deities, he was called, and Tlatzaltoatl, were rendered into defiant beasts. And they became the transgressors of what I call Marianismo. The cult, Marianismo, is the cult of the Virgin Mary and her subject position as the Mother of God. So imposed by entrenched Christianity. So as an opposing force, Coatlicue and her deities, Tlatzolteo and Cihuacol, helped to explain the whole dichotomy, the whole virgin dichotomy that has shaped gender relations and sexuality in post-Spanish colonial sites. It's very interesting because if we think about the difference, in different cultures you talk about the whole virgin dichotomy, but in this Mexican Chicano tradition, it really goes, in my analysis, I really insist that this is very specific. It goes back to these deities of the Coatlicue and how they are transformed in the process of Christianization and colonization, because it's the imposition of Christian values that is transforming the deities, you know, and the role of women. So let me see where I. So it helps us to explain the whole virgin dichotomy that has shaped gender relations and sexuality. Thus, the desirable qualities of the woman based on Coatlicue Tonantzin, La Virgin of Guadalupe, are goodness, humbleness, dedication to family, and virginity. So, and there are the undesirable traits. As embodied in Cihuacóatl and Tlatzolteo, which is La Malinche, are kind of more treachery, lying. If as you know, La Malinche was seen as a traitor of her culture for becoming the mistress of Hernán Cortés. I'm almost done. Okay, let's see. 5 minutes. Okay, let me. I'm almost there. So in Mexican or Chicano culture, the virgin whore dichotomy then is tied specifically to Coatlicue's Christian transformations and beliefs. And Twitley's transformation and beliefs about, we can say, paganism. I mean, you think paganism, the devil, and the female transgression as symbolized by Eve. So the merging of those beliefs produces new depictions of Tonantzin and related goddesses. So colonial and Christian imposition negatively associated the Christian serpent, devil, Eve, evil, and sin with these Aztec sacred energies. They came and imposed all their values to these sacred energies and were transformed. So this was the case of Malintzin Tenepal, which is La Malinche, or Doña Marina, who served as Hernán Cortés' interpreter and mistress and became the mother of the mestizo son. So additionally, she became the intermediator between the two cultures. And she, La Malinche, as she was branded by the Indians, has become a symbol of the cultures of the cultural tyranny embedded in the process of colonization. So artists, critics, and historians have repeatedly noted the historical and mythical representation of La Malinche as a paradigm of the legacy of betrayal. In some cases, proposing new readings as an attempt to rescue her from her condemnation. And that's something that most Chicanas are also doing, how they rescue these deities and in particular how the evil deities were embodied in La Malinche and how we have to rescue them from their condemnation. So she was the first victim of Spanish colonization. She was known for her ability to speak and understand many different languages. And let me move on and try to conclude because I know my time is almost over. But this is a depiction of the legacy of La Malinche and how she's placed within the context of colonization. And you see in the back Cortés and the whole the violence of colonization. And her legacy and its recurring deployment embody the unresolved upheaval and cataclysm of indigeneity. Her legacy is a crucial testimony that indigenous women and their encounter with Spanish men were predestined by the conquest and by the conquistadores' insatiable sexual desire for them. As a paradigm of a colonial sexual encounter and as a cultural construct, her presence traverses farther the geopolitical sites of colonization. And let me here then, let me conclude. I'm going to pass a few pages here. But let me conclude by saying that I from Coatlicue's deities, Tlazoltel and Cihuacoatl, and their embodiment in La Malinche, to the goddess of Tonantzin, now the Virgin of Guadalupe, there is a revisionist critique. A revisionist critique is evident, representing critical forces that have shaped both the feminine and feminist consciousness of contemporary Chicanas and Mestizas. And this is the end. Thank you.
Our next presenter, Skawinate Tricia Fragnito, is an artist who focuses on creating projects for the World Wide Web, which she believes is an extraordinary art delivery system. Her projects have included Cyber Powwow, a virtual gallery and chat space, Imagining Indians in the 25th Century, a web-based paper doll time travel journal, this is one of my favorites, and Time Traveler TM, a machinima series for which she won the 2009 Best New Media Award at Imagine Native. She's been honored recently be named a 2011 Eitel Jorg Fellowship for Native American Art, And she also co-founded Nation to Nation, a First Nations art collective in 1994. Her presentation today is called Aboriginal Territories in Cyberspace.
Hello, hello, good. And so, oh yeah, I was going to start off by speaking Mohawk. Sego, Skawanadi Yujats. I want to thank you all for being here. I especially want to thank my Kanyangehage family and people and the Ungwehunwe in the audience, but all of you are wonderful to come at 9 o'clock on a Saturday morning. I'm really happy to be invited to speak here. Laura, thank you so much, and all of the others who were instrumental in bringing me here. I really wanted a chance to dress up as my avatar. I never had an excuse before. So that's what I'm doing. My talk is actually called Indigenous Avatars, Talk About Wannabes. But, of course, the panel being called Performing Trans-Indigeneity, which I couldn't say that well, the trans part I thought would be, this would how I represent it this way. So Native people, you know, Indians are showing up in cyberspace, but perhaps some avatars are showing up in real space. Okay, so what I'm going to be talking about is, I'm going to try and give you a little bit of background about my work, or about actually one particular project. And then the rest of it is basically a slideshow of just a small selection of hundreds and hundreds, actually, of images I've been taking in Second Life to document and enjoy the imagery, the things I've been seeing there. So without further ado, forward, please. I should say that Aboriginal Territories in Cyberspace is actually the research network that I co-direct along with Jason Lewis. Many of you are familiar with Shirk Grants here. I think we talked about it yesterday. And we were founded with a wonderful Shirk Grant. Wonderful especially because someone like me, an artist without any kind of true affiliation, or not actually, let's put it this way, not a professor at a university, gets to be a co-investigator on this grant. It's a special grant for Aboriginal research networks that allows people with knowledge, or Aboriginal people who might not be professors or whatever, to be considered co-investigators. So Aboriginal Territories in Cyberspace is something Jason and I have been thinking about for a very long time. We wanted to make sure that Aboriginal people were participating in the development of this new frontier, and that because it sort of felt like one of the first times we could be there at the ground up, sort of at the beginning like everybody else. And we wanted to make sure, So that's what we're doing. We are talking about web pages. We are talking about virtual spaces. We're talking about games. We just want to see Native people in there. And we're doing that in lots of different ways. And I'm not going to talk about all those ways because I only have 20 minutes. But I am going to talk about one way, which is the next slide, please. Time Traveler TM is my project. It's a machinima project, which means it's a movie, or a machinima is a movie shot in a virtual environment. Time Traveler TM is a story of an angry young Mohawk man named Hunter who lives in the year 2121. And he, in 2121, actually, could you go to the next slide, please? In 2121, there is a new technology called the Time Traveler TM, which allows you to don these cool glasses that recreates for you in living 3D color any historical event that you would like to participate in or to watch. And so this is the first page of the website, which you are very welcome to come and take a peek at. And on that website, you can see our first, our first episode. There will be 10 episodes in the series. And I'm going to just keep it at that. I'm going to try and keep everything short, and at the end you can ask questions. There's so many projects and so much to say about every project that I don't know sometimes how little I can give you. So if I'm not making sense, you know, try and tell me. next, please. So it's important for me to try and explain to you for a minute why we chose Second Life to create this machinima. Second Life is a virtual environment that, like it says here, user-created. Is that the big selling point of Second Life is that it's highly customizable. So you can get in there and you're given a default avatar, and I'll show you what they look like in a second. But once you got that default avatar, you just need a little bit of skill. I mean, and the more skill you have, the better, the more you can customize. But you can make skins, shapes, shapes being body shapes, jewelry, buildings, complete sets. So I used, when I discovered Second Life, and plus you get to talk to people from Australia, you know, at the same in real time. So, I mean, it's really, I felt, rich environment. And we actually bought, Indians bought virtual land. We have an island in cyberspace, which we bought. Like, we pay rent, we pay money for every year. And but we needed that space. It's kind of like getting a studio. We needed that space to be able to build our sets and leave them there and be able to come back to them and film there, you know, do our things. So so that's my Second Life. Next, please. And I couldn't resist showing you this one because it says, "Who will you be?" So that's just from the Second Life website. Like, who will we be? And next, please. Okay, so the default avatar is next, please. So this is called Girl Next Door. So I wanted to, next, please. Boy Next Door. Next. This is Professional Female. Next. Professional Male. Next. Rock Star Female. No, wait. Rocker Female, actually, I think. Not Star. Next. Rocker Male. Next. Okay, Gamer Girl. Okay, I just had to show you her little, like, her personal... Okay, Gamer Boy 2, which is an elf guy, right? And I started in Second Life 3 years ago, and I have to say that 3 years ago, they were all the avatars, the default avatars were all really white, and you know, and now I can see that they're trying to like expand, and what is interesting, like they definitely had, like there's also an Asian guy, and there's like a few different races represented, but what they're really doing is they know who their users are. They're going for like different sort of subcultures, you know? So I thought that was really fun and interesting. But, you know, no native people. But that's okay. Okay, keep going, please. So these are in Second Life, it's really, you do a lot of explaining of what Second Life is capable of or what you are capable of doing in Second Life to really try and understand what is going on here. So. You can make things, but of course everyone can, so everyone's making things, and the good people who do make stuff really nice, they sell them. And so you go around shopping, you spend a lot of time in Second Life shopping, unless you want to figure out how to make things. And we've tried to figure out, I'm so lucky, I have a team of about 6 brilliant students who help me make stuff in Second Life, and like some stuff's really hard, like skin. But anyway, here's something that you can buy in Second Life. We've been searching for native costumes, of course. Next, please. And I love her, right? Native design Indian princess costume with fringles. That's included in the package when you buy them. Next, please. And hair, of course. Like with Barbies, hair is ultra important in Second Life. And it's really hard to make. And default hair, which you will see later, is really awful. So you totally buy hair all the time. Okay. Next. And I just had to show you like a guy thing. Like the stuff, there's you untold amount, like I can't even tell you the thousands of images and shopping we've had to do to find like what we've eventually bought and yeah. And like the crap, I mean, that we've had to go through. But and another thing, so I'll move on in a second from this, but I just need to tell you that these slides, I had a really hard time ordering because we could have talked about things in a number of ways. I've got these kind of groupings now. So I figured you are all smart. You can figure it all out at the end, like what order it should go in for you. But so there's a sort of bit of out of orderness perhaps coming up. So let's go. Oh, yes. So this is moi. Exos Voyager is my name in Second Life. The way Second Life works is you get to choose your own first name, totally, but then the last name is like supplied from a short menu. So XOX was my name all the time, like my first name. I've been in chat rooms for quite a while, and so that's why I wanted to keep that kind of continuity going. And then Voyager, of course, is the ship from Star Trek, so I had to have that. Okay. So I just thought I'd show you my costume and just tell you a tiny bit about it. You know, the white hair, like, I don't know why I ended up loving white hair in Second Life. But the braids were kind of, this is what I'm trying to talk about is how I try to be me and let other people also know that I was native in Second Life. So that's what was kind of going on here. And so the B part's the tutu, of course. And then the ribbon shirt, this is the first ribbon shirt I made, actually, in Second Life. And actually, this is, no, it's not the first one I made in real life. And so Second Life clothing is really always tight, like you can't loosen it. It's just basically a mapping of texture on the body. If you know any 3D like modeling stuff, which I've recently learned. So basically, it's very hard to get anything loose in Second Life. Yeah, that's the basic rule. So next, please, and I'll just show you a few other. This is early me with the green hair, and I had this costume. This is what Hunter, I wanted Hunter to wear something like this, but I couldn't figure out how to make it myself, so I got this free one. So you'll notice it again and again, because it ended up being kind of the Abtec costume, you know, uniform. And that was this punk guy that I met. I was like, how did you get that hair? I'm looking for a mohawk. How did you get that hair? But he was German, and he wouldn't answer me. Next, please. And that's our Abtec t-shirt. I just wanted to show you, because a student made this out of our logo, and I think it's just so beautiful. Next. And that's another. So I found this place. I'm like, oh, these are really nice feathers. Like a place that sold, you know, amongst all the hundreds of things, there was like a few things that were nice to wear. So my long black hair. Go ahead. And my pink hair, because pink is a thing for me, because like I'm half red and half white. So pink. So, and that's, oh, that's B-Box, who's another one. That's one of my research assistants. She's wearing the uniform, and you'll see a little more of her later. So next, please. So yeah, back in the day, that is default hair, the purple hair, okay? So when I'm like, yeah, it's crazy, it's hideous, you know, but she liked it, so that was cool. So that's Bonnie Quaid in real life, and I love Curry, I Heart Curry was her name in Second Life. That's me, and that's B Parsons in real life, and B Box in, and you'll just nice to mention their names, because they've had so, they were my partners in this explore, like we were exploring this new, very commercial land. Next, please. Okay, so here were like the first Indians we met in Second Life. We were just like, oh my God! Like we were so excited and happy, and they were, they told us they were lesbians, and this was their place that they made for their, kind of like their utopia, you know? But we were just like, oh my God, we love your costumes, you know? We love your outfits. So next, and here she's checking out her ass, I think. I'm not sure. Next. And I did think those girls were kind of over the top with their dress, and I was still kind of searching for a happy medium, and I was looking to outfit Hunter, who's from the future. So here I see this woman, and her name, I don't know if you can make it out, but her name, it says Gunasadage at the top, and then Guanita Hawks is her Second Life name. I'm like, oh my God, another Mohawk in Second Life, you know? So I'm, like, talking to her. I'm starting to, like, ask her stuff without, like, because also she doesn't know who I am, so I can't, like, be like, hey, I'm Mohawk, too. You know, you have to sort of, I don't know, be a little cooler than that, it seems to me. So I was talking to her, and it turned out she was from France, and she just knew about Gunasadage. She'd never been to Canada, but she knew about Gunasadage because of the Mohawk crisis. And so, anyway, it was very interesting, and she has become, like, she has made a huge island since then, like, that sells all native stuff, where we get some stuff. Some of it's cool, and some of it's, like, crazy. But anyway, yeah, she was like, wow, you know, here's the girl with the black hair, but, like, kind of, like, some color and the feather, just, you know, and, of course, the camouflage pants, which I've been wanting to ask, which you don't have to answer now, but, you know, I thought that was, like, just a Mohawk thing, like, since 1990, like, that camouflage was cool fashion. In 1990, I know it's become, like, bigger since, but... Anyway, it's a question I've been having. Okay, next, please. So this is Bonnie. You can recognize her by her hair. And we were invited to do performance in it was called Second Live. So it was a performance series in Second Life. And I just wanted to show you what she chose. She wanted to get the kitschiest thing she could find. She's like, I want to find the biggest dream catcher ever. And she did it. And I'd love to tell you about the performance. And afterwards I can, but I can't tell you right now because there isn't time. Next, please. Next, please. So this is the original Hunter. Because I couldn't find, like, that's the darkest skin I could find. I didn't know how to make the eyes brown yet. And, skin in Second Life, comes with facial hair, like male skin. And so it seems to be a thing to have facial hair as much as possible because it's kind of hard and it differentiates you from the default avatars. So it was quite hard at the time to find nice dark skin for Hunter. And I just want to note his, like, just wanted you to see his little apartment, which is this super prim or super, you know, primitive futon, and just everything's like boxy and square. It was early Second Life week, and it also we're looking for free stuff still. Tell me if I got something wrong with my outfit. Okay, next please. This is Hunter now. It's so light, really. What I wanted to show you in this picture was his Confederacy T-shirt, which I call it his distress Confederacy tee because I've got like the Confederacy, the Iroquois Confederacy sign on there, but it's all like kind of cool punk. But you can't see it very well. So next, and I made this T-shirt. And here's now, and here's his apartment with his jetpack in the background, and his weapons collection on the wall. Next, please. And here it is again. And I just wanted to show you, like, there's just want to have a bit of a side note about how it's not just what you wear or your, I mean, there's skin and hair and then what you wear, but then there's, like, what you choose to, what your surroundings are that also are kind of native signifiers. So he's got, like, this, you know, this hide for a carpet, and the weapons have, like, a little bit of a native theme going on. He's got cigarettes in there. This is a original... This is a jetpack we bought, and his old apartment, and I just want, and the old logo. This is like, so this is about 2 years ago, and then if you go next is like the updated version with like, we made a custom super cool jetpack, and yeah, that's pretty much it, his cool blue camo pants. Next, please. Okay, next, please. Bebox was, like I said, right back from the beginning, she's been searching for native stuff for us. And she was super excited this one time because she found these powwow dresses that looked pretty cool. You know, like they were pretty cool. And so, and then she found some cornrows? I can't think. Anyway, you know, that braided hair that a lot of girls wear at powwows. She puts on the glasses and the cigarette, you know. It's just like a really, she calls this powwow a go-go. So, next please. And then she was looking for hair, and she was looking to make Beatbox, she was looking to make a character called, that's going to either be called Gudzi or Goroko Howie. I'm not really sure yet. But upcoming in the series, there's a female lead. And so that's who we're trying to build here. Next. And yeah, artwork came of this. She and I collaborated on a piece called, we called it Guided by the Four Directions. We took the powwow go-go girl, and we took the Gudzi. And this is another girl she tried on, more champagne. And this is like the Indian, the invisible Indian, you know. Left with no body and just like this headdress, this kind of fake headdress that I don't know if was ever really worn by any native in any native group. Okay, thank you. Next, please. Okay, so this is just cool shots of Beatbox. Next, please. Love it. Her toolbox because she's a builder. Next, please. Indians in love. We never see that. Next, please. and then, so I guess... Okay, this is where I wasn't sure where I should put these, but the Minnesota Massacre is my next episode. It takes place in 1862, so we worked pretty... There's, luckily, a lot of role-playing games happening. A lot of people doing role-play in Second Life, so we used a lot of that. And here's Hunter in that episode. Next, please. And again, and this beautiful cabin that Angela Gabbro, one of my research assistants, made. And, you know, next, please. So, yeah, and here's interim... Got one of, so he's got four Dakota buddies in this episode, and oh my God, we just couldn't find the shapes and skins to make these guys, and we tried everything. I photographed some of my cousins, Jake, and I, you know, we tried to make our own skin, and we were not good at it. Like I couldn't find a picture to show you, but it looked hideous. And so anyway, here's this guy with a demo skin on, which basically, I don't know how well you can see it, but you know, like, it's got like these crazy huge feet and crazy huge hands, and it's got the word demo all over it. Anyway, so, but we finally figured it all out. We made some hair. Next, please. And here they are in a very tense scene in the episode. And they're all kitted out with weapons. And I just wanted to point out to you, this gun comes in two versions. It's like white and, or it's like gun and native gun. it's got like that leather stuff hanging from it. And, you know, and we had to really mix and match and found things all over Second Life, like the turquoise belt buckles. And, you know, and one guy is like super traditional, you know, he's like bare chested and I'll show you him again in another slide, and, you know, just leggings and loincloth, whereas this other guy is, you know, this guy is wearing like a shirt, because at that time that's what was going on. There was like people mixing the European clothing with the other, with the traditional clothing. Next, please. I just want to show you, like, it's not all tense scenes. There's some joking and laughter. Next scenes. Next, please. Okay, and yeah, this is a good way to show you my death scene. But also, I want to show you the beautiful moccasins that we found. And we are finding nicer and nicer stuff as time goes on. There's like, I just did a search earlier, like this week, for some native stuff. And there's really beautiful stuff happening now. Next. Oh, next. And talk about wannabes. The day after this movie came out, I like saw an avatar walking around in Second Life. So that's it. Thank you.
So our next presenter is Jolene Ricard, who is a visual historian, artist, and curator interested in issues of indigeneity within a global context. She's the recipient of a Ford Foundation research grant and is conducting research on the Americas, Europe, New Zealand, and Australia, culminating in a new journal on indigenous aesthetics. She also has a forthcoming book on visualizing sovereignty. She recently served as interim chair for the art department at Cornell University and is an affiliated faculty member in the American Indian program at Cornell. She is a 2010-2011 recipient of a Cornell University Society of the Humanities Fellowship on the thematic topic of global aesthetics. She was also recently in residence at the Banff Center for the Arts for the Painter House Conversations, and she is the author of numerous essays, book chapters, and exhibition catalogs, and curator of multiple exhibits on First Nations art presented in the U.S., Canada, and Europe. Her talk today is on performing indigeneity in colonial settler nation. From James Luna to Erica Lord.
Okay, Chuan Askinahan, good morning. And I'd like to say Nyawa for those of you that have come out this morning. And I also like to just recognize the original inheritors of this territory and thank them for their hosting us today. I should have gone first. There's just nothing I could say to follow the avatar and the and the indigenous peoples of the Americas. Alicia's presentation. I'm sort of struck by a lot of thoughts keep coming to me because I'm just finishing a round of research where I'm looking at the question of what is indigeneity globally, and it's easy to make definitions or to make alliances or to make connections between the Americas, Australia, and New Zealand. When we begin to venture beyond that space, the construction of indigeneity becomes much more problematic. And so one of the things that I'm thinking about right now is how all of this, how indigeneity is in fact performed. And one of the sites that I think is most interesting in terms of performance has always been the museum, which is where a number of my interventions have taken place. And so I'd like to share with you first an initial locator. In 2002, I was asked to act as guest curator for the National Museum of American Indians formation of the new museum in Washington, D.C., I was asked to come in and curate two exhibits of the three permanent exhibits. One was focused on history, one is focused on contemporary culture. The space is really complex, and I'm really proud to say that the exhibits, I actually made it to the finish line because a number of curators were dismissed. And so I see my work as a curatorial intervention. And this exhibit, Our Lives, is considered the contemporary component of it. I collaborated with Gabby Tayak as well as there were other curators involved in this exhibit. So there were like discrete areas of the installations that one could take ownership of. And then there were other parts of the exhibit that belonged to the museum. And so I think all of this, ultimately, if you've read anything about the reception of the National Museum of the American Indian, indicates that there has been some problem in terms of the cogency or flow of the exhibits. And so I can't solve that problem for you or for the museum because I was brought in such a late phase. But what I'd like to talk about is very specific issues that I dealt with within this that I think are relevant to this question of performance. And so this is an installation that came out of the awareness that the engagement or encounter with indigenous peoples is primarily through the image. And in from the moment of contact to the 20th century, the images vary from print to photograph. So within the past 200 years, a relatively short period of time when we think about history at large, but within a relatively short period of time, our image has been canonized, in a sense, in the photograph. And so this canonization of our image actually comes out of that first encounter. And I argue that it's that first encounter that we continue to have to encounter and consistently deconstruct. We haven't moved beyond that phase yet as settler nations or as indigenous peoples. And so we haven't really been able to overcome that intense locator. And so in this case, we're looking at the work of Catlin. Chad Smith and I, working on the historic part of the gallery, did an installation where we capitalized on the Catlin portfolios, which, of course, are part of the property of the Smithsonian. We installed actual Catlins in combination with, you'll see one cell there. If we could bring the lights down so the images, can we do that? And we counterposed these images with an actual media piece that gave a little piece of that history. And so what I'm thinking about in terms of performativity is that what are the constellation of images and ideas that one has in their mind when approaching either an actual Native person, an actual Indigenous person, or an imagined Indigenous person. And so we're always dealing with this complex negotiation. And so I would argue that it goes back to a very systematic set of images that were created at early contact that, in part, this installation in the contemporary gallery, the contrast between the contemporary and the historic, are meant to be in dialogue. The contemporary gallery is meant to act as an indicator to begin to rethink the gestural posture of indigeneity through the most conservative of portrait photography, which is, in fact, where a number of the locators or stereotypes of indigeneity are consistently reinstalled. And so when you recall historic material and bring it back into contemporary discourse, you're reinstalling those stereotypes unless you've done the necessary intellectual work to unpack what those images mean. And so, of course, we know that hasn't been fully embraced in our society today. And so there's more work to be done in this area. One of the big issues in this encounter has been the question of how it is, in fact, we construct our own identities. And this is where I'm saying that, you know, this is so old school compared to where Skawanade is in relationship to this imagined space of indigeneity. But the actual legal, political, physical, or corporal space of indigeneity is mired in this place of fractionalization identity, which is, I think, quite curious, because when we look at most indigenous systems, when we look at most indigenous epistemes and cultural constructions, what we acknowledge is that we had systems and ways to accommodate for ways in which our peoples moved through generations. So amongst the Ongwe Onwe or the Haudenosaunee or the Iroquois people, there was a simple yet profound tradition that we are who our mothers are. Simply put, we are who our mothers are. Yet today, we've complicated this notion with this idea of half-breed or full-blood or some kind of factionalization piece of this. And so in our communities today, there's what I would call an orthodox movement to reclaim this notion of full-blood, which, of course, most people in the world today would acknowledge as junk science, because there's no such idea as a full blood of anything. Yet somehow, we get away with this. And so I wanted to create just a little modest intervention on this. And so the media piece that I'm going to show you actually tiles in this installation. We could see, here's the installation, and this is actually a media piece that actually visualizes this concept. So I took the cover of the book, of the exhibit catalog that represented the opening of NMAI, which you can see represents, you know, the four directions. And I think what's interesting and complicated about any national or global discussion of indigeneity is that whose culture, whose particular civilization are we in fact discussing? And so in this case, you know, we're using a very plains cultural frame in order to make this discussion. And it's so this piece was done in 2004. The exhibit actually opened in 2004. The models or participants of this are actually First Nations, Aboriginal, or Indigenous peoples who have relocated to Washington, D.C. generationally. And so most of these people have actually, in fact, no tie to some sort of, you know, fictive, original, Indigenous territory, but in fact have been in the metropolitan area of Washington, D.C. generationally. And they had been left out of the discussion or vetting sessions around the construction of the National Museum of the American Indian because the museum and the curatorial staff were very concerned about reaching the grassroots, about reaching the, you know, the real Native peoples. And I came in on the project I live in my own community. I grew up there. But I've also lived in New York, I've also lived in Ottawa, I've also lived in Toronto, London, Paris, you know, and so, but I'm coming from that, you know, I'm coming from that space. And I went to D.C. and I said, wait a minute, what about the people in this part of the world? What about the people, Native people that are here? What is their voice? And so I did a call for Native peoples in the metropolitan Washington, D.C. area. I had over 300 Native people respond, of which we documented about 50 of them. And they became the participants for this this idea of questioning. The intention of this exhibit was to question this idea of factionalized quantum. And current research demonstrates at the museum, this is the other side of the installation, which breaks down the different discussions around how so-called notion of identity is constructed within the Americas. And in this, I used a signature piece by James Luna. This is a photograph of his performance, the artifact piece done in 1987, as a way of talking about this idea of how it is we construct our identities. So there are a couple ideas that I'd just like to share with you about just this point. One, I think in the beginning or the introductory remarks, there was a comment made about how the discussion of First Nations, Aboriginal, or indigeneity is at least present in Canada. And I would agree with that to a certain degree. But what I want to also point out is that as far as legal rights are concerned, I don't think I would get an argument that Indigenous peoples in the United States actually have more secured legal rights within the U.S. legal system than Canadian natives have in the Canadian legal system. And so I think that there is an interesting question around the balance between the perception of acceptance versus hardwired into a system, a place for indigeneity. And so my interest in this question of indigeneity globally is to begin to look at how just that relationship between colonial settler nations works in terms of the representation versus the legal status, and how these two things work either in tandem or in contrast, and how we are then located both philosophically and psychologically within these systems. So there's a question of how we locate ourselves, and then there's a question of how we are received, the reception of our location. Now, Luna's piece, done in 87, which is considered the sort of base of a certain kind of conceptual Indigenous performance, is actually in dialogue with the question of the Indigenous body as a primitivized archaeological text. And so I'm sure that most of you are familiar with this piece, and you could certainly follow up on the close reading of the piece because it's been completely consumed within the Academy. It's interesting that NMAI has restaged a response to or a dialogue with the Luna piece through the work of Erica Lord. And it's the artifact piece revisited 20-some years after in 2007. And so what's important to note is that both of these images are documents of a performance. This is a document of a performance. And so where is her body different? Has anything changed from the original text of James Luna's body as a deconstruction or challenge to the primitivized archaeological text, the anthropological text? Is Lord's body just a continuation in that narrative? Have there been significant interventions between that time and this work? These are some of the questions that I'm thinking about in the restaging of this piece. But before we can answer that, I think we need to think about some other kinds of ways in which the body is represented. Now, why the body? And I'm going to argue why the body is both a sign of wealth yet poverty. And so when the only thing that you have to write on is your body, I think in some way that's a sign of having been stripped of everything else. At the same time, the insertion of one's body is also the impulse to reclaim control over the body as signifier of future generations. And so from within Indigenous communities, the reclamation of the body is a significant act. But outside of our communities, I think it should be read that our bodies are the most potent visual signifier because everything else has been in some way taken or consumed. And so in contrast to the very familiar work of Rebecca Belmore's piece, and what's and of course it's important to remember that this is an artwork of an expression of an idea. It is not a still shot of a performance. And so even when we're encountering this work, it's you have to be an incredibly sophisticated consumer of images in order to make the constant adjustments to actually even read this work. And so I think that the work of Jessica Lord is interesting because she brings to the discussion, which is very different than Luna, a recapture of a certain agency in the sexualized body of the indigenous person. At the same time, she's also playing out this question of our own complex space or ideas of identity. And one must always acknowledge that this complexity of identity is both imposed and from the outside, but also self-imposed. One of the most startling things I found in my research for the installations at NMAI is that within the U.S. legal record, there is really no law that tells us that we have to use the quantum system as a way of regulating our identities. But it is something that we've accepted as part of the way in which we police ourselves. And so I just think that's an important point, and I'm not sure exactly, I mean, I think that the Canadian story is very different, and it's interesting to note that I'm now becoming familiar with how this works in Australia and in New Zealand, and it would be inappropriate to kind of condense that into just one statement. But what's interesting to me is that within the discourse of art, because of the shift of the notion of diaspora from being recognized as a predominantly Jewish to then African expression or experience, the relationship between India and Great Britain, this way in which post-colonialism is located in a theoretical space, the idea of colonialism is now beginning to surface as something that one needs to understand in order to critique visual expressions. And so we see in the work of Lord and others this focus on colonialism. And so recently, and you can I share this with you, you can look at an exhibit at NMAI curated by Kathleen Ash-Milby on this complex space of identity that she's constructed in this notion of hide. And there are a number of ways in which this works. And so she brings forward the work of an Aboriginal artist from Canada, Casey Adams. And in this case, she's constructing, she has a beaded t-shirt, I Survived Colonization. But what's significant about this, along with the work that Erica Lord is doing, is the overt direction towards this idea of engaging a very slick, advertising, marketing kind of aesthetic. And this is part of Adam's objective, that not only is she interested in the political potency of inserting this idea of I survived colonialism, and I don't think I have to rework in this audience the complex symbolism of fur, white beads, and the use of these beads in an ongoing colonial narrative. But what I think is new in this is this insistence of this kind of homage to beauty or to the aesthetic. And so we have to ask ourselves, okay, what does this mean, this addition of wanting to engage this very contemporary seduction? I don't think it's that new. I think this idea of the indigenous body as a sexualized space is really old. But it's about the subjectivity of the artist. When they're practicing and working with this with intent, there is a sense then to try and reclaim the authority of this sensuality. So the shift from sexuality to sensuality is, I think, a very potent statement about empowerment. So why? So aha. A couple days ago, at the opening, a couple weeks ago, and on the other side of the world, in Australia, at the Australian Sydney Biennale, there was the overt inclusion of Indigenous voice. Indigenous, there was a forum, a full day on problematizing ideas about indigeneity, hardwired into the structure by David Elliott in the Sydney Biennale. Now, there are some people that argue, well, of course they had to do that because the market for Aboriginal dot painting is so strong that to exclude Aboriginal art would have been a death knell for the ongoing sale of contemporary Aboriginal art. So it really wasn't a great political coup to be included in that Biennale. But at the same time, the way in which the Indigenous voices that were put into the discussion they were all very contemporary, current, etc. And so a performance by Skeena Reese, I think, defines in a sense this moment. She contrasts the incredibly complex visual footage from Oka with which took place in the early 1990s with an event that took place in the United States as it related to the rejection of Marlon Brando's Oscar by Sachin Littlefeather in the 1970s, and she turned this into a performance piece. And the tape is about 4 minutes long. Is it okay to play it, or can we play it without signed?
Okay.
Thank you.
Better be setting yourself a damn receipt to see the awakening's beginning. The heat for the eagles and comets and third sound. Feed for us, fishes and hunters in the spirit world will meet for us. We've got the angels and the demons in the sweet for us. And everything for these like trading magic blues for them. So no, we're not trying to be in the mood, cause we're close.
Tonight, I need you to think for me, 'cause we already can think for free.
Basically, Sashin rejects the award. And so in conclusion, I just want to tie together the overt reclamation of sensuality in the Skeena Reeves piece as an indicator of where Indigenous performance, one way in which Indigenous performance can be read as a sign of both a sovereigntist expression and self-determination. Thank you.